5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I believe that every soul is sacred. I believe that every life is impactful, whether they witness 80 years of sunsets or none at all. I believe that one night several years ago, a young mother and her unborn baby met at the intersection of life and death. Atop this treacherous yet peaceful precipice, they embraced briefly before parting. The baby girl, destined to be with her creator, never having breathed a breath of air, yet the gentle reverberations of her existence have traveled through space and time and touched me. The mother, destined to return back to her world of healing, forever changed, forever committed to make change. My preparation for each podcast is a solemn ritual, a holy task for holy people, for our cancer survivors. It begins with the diligent research and study that has been ingrained in me over 3 decades of medical practice. Yet what I think each episode will be never is. God laughs at my plans and slowly reveals what the episode should be. One of our guests today was just a name on a paper, nothing more than the dozens of names on the dozens of articles I read for each interview. I began my focus on the paper itself, a paper about trust, about shifting relationships, about partnerships instead of predefined castes and roles between patients, caregivers, and health systems. This young mother, this accomplished healer, through her work, opened a door, and I entered a new space. The space was at first frightening and sad. In that space, I saw myself as a young intern, beaten down with fatigue, self-doubt, and frustration. I could not find a vein to draw blood from this strung-out Vietnam vet who quelled and soothed his wartime trauma with dirty needles, unwittingly closing and scarring down those tubes of life that could take in our potions and our poisons, as well as draw out hidden and obscure medical information. We were in a crowded hallway. Short, dirty white coats, blurry in their haste, made me dizzy. An evil descended upon me and possessed me. I quickly exposed his groin, and in front of anyone who cared to bear witness to my brutality, quickly filled up tube after tube of majestic purple blood from his femoral trunk. I began to cry. I long forgot about that image. I long forgot about that patient. I long forgot about what the demands of training extracted from my humanity. I thought, I was convinced, I was even awarded for being different, for being unique, for being caring. But she made me realize, especially during times of stress and strain, that we all are vulnerable to reverting to the primitive, isolating, compartmentalizing, detached survival tactics we were taught as students and residents. I decided that I could not change that ugly reality, but what I could do was dig deeper into her story of loss, of death, of illness, of recovery, from the perspective of patient, not caregiver, and her subsequent work to shift this broken paradigm of how we train, how we communicate, how we heal will be our new beacon and benchmark for my practice and for our podcast. I quickly ordered her book and began reading. I then ordered a box of her book, one for every person in our cancer center. I YouTubed her lectures and her interviews, and I read and reread her articles. I am certain that through her story and her work, she will speak to you, cancer survivors, not as a cancer survivor, but as a global survivor whose experiences transcend the boundaries of any specific illness and unite all patients of all illnesses who share the life experience of pain and loss and fear and tragedy. Rena Audish, Dr. Rena Audish, is the author of In Shock, a critically acclaimed best-selling memoir based on her own critical illness. She is a sought-after public speaker, delivering inspirational keynote addresses to groups ranging from professional medical societies to members of Congress to organizations combating homelessness. A pulmonary and primary care physician and critical care physician, she serves as the current director of the pulmonary hypertension program at Henry Ford Hospital. She also serves as medical director of care experience for the system, where she has integrated compassionate communication strategies and narrative medicine practice into the curriculum. Dr. Audish received the Schwartz Center National Compassionate Caregiver of the Year Award in 2017. She was named Physician of the Year by Press Ganey in 2017 for her work on improving communication and received the Critical Care Teaching Award in 2016. She has been inducted into the Alpha Omega Alpha Medical Society and the Gold Humanism Honor Society. Her narrative nonfiction essays have been published in the Examined Life Journal, Intima, Chest, and the New England Journal of Medicine. She has written editorials for the Harvard Business Review, Annals of Internal Medicine, The Washington Post, and the Detroit Free Press. Her essay, The Shape of the Shore, was awarded a Sydney by the New York Times and was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. Prior to coming to Henry Ford, Dr. Audish completed her training at Mount Sinai Beth Israel in Manhattan. She attended Wayne State University Medical School and completed her undergraduate degree at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She is board certified in internal medicine, pulmonary, and critical care medicine. The primary author of the paper we will be reviewing today is Dr. Leonard Barry. Dr. Barry is a dear friend of ours here at the Croc Podcast. He is the University Distinguished Professor of Marketing, Regents Professor, and holds the M.B. Zale Chair in Retailing and Marketing Leadership in the Mays Business School at Texas A&M University. He is also a past presidential professor for teaching excellence. Dr. Berry is a senior fellow of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, studying service improvement in cancer care for patients and their families. He is also an adjunct professor, Faculty of Health Sciences at the University of South Denmark. Professor Berry has published 13 books in all, including Discovering the Soul of Service, On Great Service, Marketing Services, Competing Through Quality, and Delivering Quality Service. He is the author of numerous academic articles in business, marketing, service, and medical journals. Professor Berry has received the Sheth Gold Medal, the American Marketing Association, William Wilkie Marketing for a Better World Award, the Paul D. Converse Award, the AMA McGraw-Hill Irwin Distinguished Marketing Educator Award, the Career Contributions to Services Marketing Award from the AMA, and the Outstanding Marketing Educator Award from the Academy of Marketing Science. He is fellow of both the American Marketing Association and the Academy of Marketing Science. Texas A&M has awarded him the Distinguished Achievement Award in Teaching and Distinguished Achievement Award in Research, the highest honor bestowed upon its faculty members. In 2014, he was inducted into Arizona State University's Carey School of Business's Hall of Fame and has been awarded the Lifetime Achievement Award for Research and Scholarship at the Mays Business School at Texas A&M. In addition, we consider Dr. Berry a personal friend of our cancer survivors, and we welcome both Dr. Rena Audish and Professor Leonard Berry today. Angel, today is going to be a spectacular podcast.
Looking forward to it. It's going to be unbelievable.
So let's take a moment. And actually, before we begin the podcast, I do have a question for you and an offer for our podcast subscribers. Do our podcast survivors have a way of contacting us?
They do as far as social media is concerned. So they can do that. They can do that by going to the website, which is under the Croc Podcast. It'll be all in the descriptions. They can visit us on our Twitter account. And with our Twitter, they're both linked to your cell phone directly. And also I have access to it as well. So if they send us a message, we'll know instantaneously.
The reason why I ask is because I want every podcast listener to know that I have been so moved by Dr. Audish's book, In Shock, that I want to offer any listener an opportunity to receive a copy of that book on behalf of the Croc Podcast, on behalf of our sponsors. We would be more than happy to provide that to you and send that to you. Just reach out to us and her book will be forthcoming. Please take a quick break while we get our speakers all set up and ready to go. Angel?
All right, my friend, we'll be back in 10 seconds. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
And when they come back, we'll have those two special guests and the return of Len. He's just a one-name basis now. He's a regular.
He's on a first-name basis.
That's it. Yeah. All right, we'll be back, folks. And don't forget, the Croc Podcast, every single Sunday, 9 a.m. Join us. We are always available. We'll be back.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome back, Croc Nation, to what I expect to be a stellar podcast. Angel Santana, have faith, let it begin.
I'm excited. I'm holding something in my hands right now that I'm just excited to open up.
I am equally excited. You know, I have to tell the Croc Nation that every time we start a podcast, we always say the same thing. We're so excited. This is going to be the greatest podcast ever. But I have to tell you, I feel like a 15-year-old schoolgirl, a fan of a colleague, began this research on this podcast about an article that turned into an actual epiphany of change, and I am so grateful to have Dr. Rena Audish, Dr. Len Berry, Professor Len Berry, our dear friend and old friend here on the Croc Podcast. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
So, Rena, as I was mentioning to you offline, as we were preparing for the podcast, you started out as a name on a paper, and I see dozens of names on dozens of papers every week as I prepare for the podcast. And all of a sudden, your name became a person. The person became an experience. The experience became a teacher. And I really felt like I was in 1964 Shea Stadium, the Beatles, you were Paul McCartney, and I was just screaming and fainting. And it was just amazing. Your book is life-changing. Every person in the Cancer Center has a copy of your book, and it's required reading. Len Berry, my dear friend who put us together, whose papers on making life better for cancer survivors, for patients in general, welcome to you, my friend. And I think that I would like to start, with your permission, with Rena, talking about that fateful, horrific night that I'm sure will haunt you forever, and it's already haunting me. Tell us a little bit about that. You're 7 months pregnant. I believe the story goes it was the last day of your fellowship, which is supposed to be a glorious day where you go to bed as a resident and you wake up as an attending, and just it wasn't in the cards for you that night.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. You're absolutely right. I was just finishing up my critical care fellowship training, and I, like a good female trainee, had tried to time a pregnancy so it wouldn't interfere with that training. And I was out for a celebratory dinner with my best friend and had just this excruciating onset of right-sided abdominal pain that was unlike anything I could have imagined pain to be. And my only thought was, whatever this is, it's going to kill me. And what it was a tumor I didn't know I had, a benign hepatic adenoma that had burst. And I was just spilling my blood volume into my abdomen. My husband rushed me to the hospital, and that set off a series of events that included us losing that pregnancy at 7 months, me going into fulminant shock, ventilatory dependent respiratory failure, multi-system organ failure, receiving 26 units of packed blood cells and cryo and FFP, going into kidney failure, and really, truly learning what it meant to be a patient, which I had somehow avoided through all of my training. I hadn't really known what it was like to be on the other side. And so those months of slowly healing in the ICU and recovering from a stroke, from the lack of blood flow to my brain, recovering from the pregnancy loss, recovering, you know, my ability to even be a physician, that time was really my greatest education. And so as hard as that transition was, I'm very grateful for that time.
I actually, this podcast episode is going to be talking about trust-based partnerships, but the actual name of the episode is going to be The Opportunity to Die.
A Chance to Die, yes.
A Chance to Die. And I want to tell you, your story itself, just even if you wrote it in crayon, would be very compelling. But you're a wonderful author. You're a wonderful writer. You had made a beautiful analogy of we as physicians, we don't want to stop in that town called illness, you know, that small sleepy town. We want to drive straight through it. And we don't want to dwell or linger there. Tell us a little bit about your perspective as first as a healer, as a physician who had never been seriously ill before, and then all of a sudden having to not only stop in that town, but actually to rent a condo in that town.
When I had only the identity of physician, I definitely saw, I viewed my value as shortening the distance between sickness and health. I thought that spending any time in the space of suffering was in a sense wasted time because I couldn't do the work of treating, which I equated with healing. When I was able to become a citizen of illness, as you say, what I saw there was that I didn't, as a patient, feel that I could be healed or even treated if my physician didn't sit with my suffering and have some awareness of what my own experience of it was. And I recognized how much in medicine we were so single-mindedly focused on disease that we actually missed illness with the broader, more human elements of it, how it affects families, how it affects recovery, how it affects life, finances, ability to work, all of that. We had been very privileged in our lens and made it very narrow. The physicians who taught me what it looked like, and the nurses especially, who taught me what it looked like to heal, were the ones who didn't shy away from the suffering, the ones who would sit at my bedside and allow me to occupy that space of grief or anger. And I trusted them differently, and they healed me differently.
And I think your education process actually began right during that night when you were, you know, got in, you know, from the security guard that didn't want you to go to the trauma room, going upstairs to the nurses that were really focusing in on the baby and not listening to you, to the obstetrical resident who sort of detached you as a person and was really more interested in the technical aspects of his devices and his technology. Just an incredible, and the words that your colleagues were using and the terms. And I mean, now that we're looking back and you were hearing it, not as a doctor, but as a patient, and hearing the words that you've actually even self, you know, knowingly go back in retrospect that you had used yourself. What an incredible moments, I guess, probably 2 hours from when you walked in the door till when you were under anesthesia, probably about 2 hours, I would think.
That was really, that time was really an awakening for me. You're right, from being triaged by hospital security and recognizing how quickly as patients, we lose agency, we lose the power of our voice to advocate because of the hierarchy, how, you know, hearing my team say, we're losing her, she's circling the drain in the operating room, and feeling like, you know, I can hear you, right? Like, how is that an okay thing to say around a patient, whether or not they're crashing? And you bring up an important point that there was nothing I heard during the hospitalization that I hadn't at some point said myself. I was a product of that training and I had really integrated a lot of that. And I knew what it meant to say you guys were losing her in a room like that. It meant that you wanted people's attention. It meant that you were trying to rally resources. It meant that you want urgency in action. It's not inherently wrong to want any of those things, but to completely disregard how it lands on our patients, what it means even to their sense of their own ability to heal. When I woke up from that first night in the surgical ICU and I heard the rounding team in the hallway and heard them say, she's trying to die on me, that was a little bit different because in that statement, we were being viewed as, you know, adversaries of each other. And that really bothered me that my intention was being stated for me. And yet again, I knew I had said that as a critical care fellow. I had certainly described patients as trying to die on me in a very vectored way, as if it were intentional. And so all of this was really an education in the power of language, the power of our words, the power of intention, and how we can be better.
Absolutely. And I just want to point out to our listeners that what you did a really beautiful job at in your book was that you recognized the skill of the people that were taking care of you. Had you been in that same circumstance in pretty much 99 out of 100 hospitals, and I'm sad to say our little community hospital would have been one of them, we would have lost you. I mean, there's no question about it. And the amazing, I mean, the skill and the experience and the ability to bring you back from where you were is nothing short of miraculous. And you are wonderful in making sure your colleagues know that. But what I think that I want to concentrate on that we spoke about the word epiphany before, my epiphany, but we'll talk about your epiphany, in that you can be both. You can be, you know, at the Ford Center, at the Ford Hospital, and be a tremendous trauma surgeon or a tremendous trauma anesthesiologist or obstetrician, and have skills to bring people from the brink of death back to life. Yet you can also be a humane, caring, empathetic individual. And imagine the power that you would have if you took both of them and put them together. And looking again, stalking you this week on all of your platforms and all of your beautiful lectures, I think that's been your life work now, is to try to marry, you know, those two skills.
I think for too long, we were taught you can have a skillful physician or you can have a physician with excellent bedside manner and they are different. And that's a lie. Empathy, compassion is a skill set. Language, serious communication is a skill set. We should develop them in our physicians as much as we develop their technical surgical skill.
So you're awake and recovering, and this recovery process was painful. It was long. I mean, you were a person that, you know, took no prisoners. I mean, there was no fooling around. You know, you wanted something, you set your mind to something and it got done. And now you had a stroke. You were on the verge of kidney failure, if not exactly in kidney failure, liver failure. Your care team did not believe in you, didn't believe in your capacity to come back. And now you're starting to sort of put a life plan in place on, boy, if I do make it back, Lord, man, things are going to be different.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And, you know, the first moment I remember feeling like my team thought I might recover is when they sent in the physical therapist to work with me. That idea that my team thought I should be able to stand somehow to me meant they thought I was going to survive. And it's such a strange thing to have to work backwards from, oh, a physical therapist is here. Maybe they think I'll live through this. But that's how little we were really communicating about the existential issues of my constant impending death during that hospitalization. I don't think we attend to that very well.
When you were at that point and you were in your recovery, and you mentioned the adversarial sort of a dyad that was developing between you and your caretakers, and now, you know, the doctor was coming out in you and you were sort of understanding what was going on, and you were also trying to help heal your husband, you know, get through the process of grieving for your daughter, and just things that no one should have to endure or live through. And that is a really nice segue into the concept of trust. So at that moment in time, and again, this is what we're going to be talking about today, trust-based partnerships are essential and achievable. That beautiful paper that you and Len and the co-authors, which we'll shout out to in a second. But tell me about how that trust began to develop for you personally, you know, as you were starting to make your recovery.
It came in small, really moments. And the first time I remember feeling a sense of trust was when I had an appointment with my liver surgeon, who had to resect half of my liver because we had found the tumor. And I met with his nurse practitioner, and she so competently and compassionately cared for me. She said, you know, I've reviewed your chart, obviously, in preparation for the visit, and you've been through so much. And I feel like I know one part of you from that, but I want to hear it from you. And she was able to hold space for all of it in a way that, you know, my physician mind would have thought was unnecessary. Like, if she has all the medical facts, why are we spending time on this? It feels like an emotional space. And as a patient, I realized, no, this is a space where trust is built. She's acknowledging my experience. She's making space for it. She's letting me know she did her preparation. She's competent. And that was my first really experience of, I absolutely know I can trust this person. And she's a great friend to this day.
I love that. That's beautiful. And I was going to actually ask Len, get Len in the game here. Len, welcome.
Well, thank you, Tom.
First question, everyone knows, because you've been on the podcast a few times, how much respect I have for you and your life's work. For someone in the business world, that's kind of like a four-letter word for we clinicians, you know, to have these people come in and tell us how they're going to create our cancer center or what they're going to do to make our hospital pretty and customer friendly. And we kind of look at you guys and with that sort of gleam of, oh my God, if I only had him in a dark alley right now, I could really show him the ropes, right? But you decided to take a different route, your route of trying to help a patient's experience, to help us see our flaws in the system. And you really devoted your life, and going back to all the accolades that I mentioned in your introduction, are so well-deserved. Can you tell us how, you know, you met Rena and how this concept of writing this paper on trust, and also at the same time as part B to the question, also shout out to your co-authors that aren't available for this podcast. I want them to be recognized as well.
Yes. Thank you, Tom. And what a pleasure to be with you again and on the Croc podcast, and with you and Angel. You two do such a wonderful job. and it's our pleasure. And I'd like to, whenever you invite me to another podcast, I'd like to involve one of my friends because I want them to experience what I experience when I work with you and Angel. And so when you issued this invitation, I immediately thought of Rena and invited Rena. As busy as she is, I just knew that she would enjoy this experience. And, you know, and so here we are. So how I met Rena is I read her paper in the New England Journal of Medicine in which she summarized the part of the experience that she's been relating in answering your questions, Tom, to begin this podcast. And it was such a powerful paper. And she focused on some of the language that she overheard as a patient that clinicians in her own hospital were using in her earshot they were using, and how offensive and upsetting some of this language was. And I felt it was such a brave paper and such an important paper. And in fact, it's one of the most reprinted, downloaded papers in the history of the New England Journal of Medicine, that particular paper. It's become a seminal paper in the literature. So I didn't know Rena, but I read this paper. And one of the habits that I have is when I read a marvelous paper, I write to the author and thank them. And about one third of the time, I get an answer, which is fine. But in Rena's case, I got an answer within about 2 days. And it was a beautiful answer. And I thought, you know what? I like this this doctor. I'm gonna find a way to get to know her. And so what happened then, try to make this long story a little shorter, but it is kind of a long
story. No, we want you to expand. Don't feel that you have to shorten it at all.
So I had another paper that I was working on with several other co-authors that was a really important paper to me, and my co-authors would work very hard on it. And the paper was about patients as hostages to their healthcare. And we were having a tough time getting it through the review process with the major medical journal. It was clear that there was disagreement in the editorial room among the editors whether the journal should publish a paper with the word hostage in the title, which had never been done before in the medical literature. And so the editor actually called me, and after we had revised it, the existing team had revised it, and met the criticisms of, you know, we thought we met them well, the criticisms of the reviewers. And so we thought we were in, and the editor called me and he said, I like the paper, I support the paper, we want to publish the paper. There's a few more things we want you to do in terms of the content, but what really would really help is if you added another physician to the byline. Because at the time we had two marketing professors, me and a colleague, who study healthcare, but we're business people. And we had a healthcare consultant and we had one physician on the byline for this potentially controversial paper. And so what the editor in chief of the journal who supported the paper, but was disagreeing with some of his colleagues, what he felt would win the day is if we had another physician, two physicians on the byline instead of just one. And I remember Rena Oddish. I remember that brave paper she had written in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I wrote her, I didn't know her, but I wrote her and I sent her the paper, I sent her the reviews. I told her the truth of, I need another doctor. Could you be that doctor? And she said, this sounds interesting. She wrote right back, it sounds intriguing. Give me a couple of days to read the article and I'll be back in touch. A couple of days later, she was back in touch. She said, this was some time ago, a few years, the paper was published in 2017. But I remember to this day, she wrote back the nicest note. She said, I love this paper and I'm on board. and give me a week to do some editing. I see some opportunities to maybe calm the waters a little bit with some of the language you're using for the physician readers and reviewers you're going to have. And I'll be back in touch. And a week later, we got a revision from Rena, and it was beautiful. And she included, Tom, in the revision that she did of that paper, her own story, a long paragraph where she told the story about how she, as an ICU physician, critical care physician in her own hospital, she felt like a hostage. And she felt like she had to do hostage bargaining syndrome, which is what we call the concept, with her nurse in order for her nurse to be willing to give her sufficient pain medication. So she tells this story in the article. So here's a doctor in her own hospital feeling like a hostage. And I think that particular story that Rena added in that third or fourth revision of the article, that got us over the hurdle. The article got published in the major medical journal of Mayo Clinic Proceedings. And recently, it won the top award in my field, marketing, for the best marketing paper of the year. And it's the only time a medical journal article will ever win that award.
Wow, what a beautiful story.
Yeah, and so, and just to finish up the story, so after that experience, I actually got in an airplane and flew to Detroit to meet Rena.
Wow, that's awesome.
And we've become the closest of friends. And Rena, I don't know, we've written 6-7 articles together now. That's and beautiful. More to come.
Beautiful. Yeah, I believe that. I wanted to just do a quick sidebar regarding Rena's article in the New England Journal. I was able to read that as well. And there was a great connection to the Croc podcast. So as you guys, Len knows and Ren is getting to know, this is a podcast for cancer survivors, trying to put together a toolbox for cancer survivors in order to get through their diagnosis, their life, their survivorship. And the first, and we basically have positioned ourselves to make modules. And each module, your particular module is about what we want in our physicians. And we talk about trust, which we'll talk about today and other things. The first module was actually defining survivorship. And Len, you were on that module with Katie Deming talking about the just term survivorship. And we talked about alternative terms and why certain terms might be, displeasing to certain survivors. And we had a very nice deep dive into that article. But our patron saint of survivorship is a doctor who just passed, Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, whose seminal paper in the 1980s published in the New England Journal of Medicine, talking about his personal battle with cancer, the diagnosis, the near-death experience that he had, as well as all of the post-treatment side effects that he endured from his surgeries and radiation and chemotherapy. That is basically the seminal paper as it relates to defining survivorship. Rena's paper is the sentinel article in the New England Journal about her personal experience with a near-death experience will be known as the sentinel article as it relates to changing the way we as healers, caregivers, interface with patients. So I wanted to bring that out to both of you. Len, you probably already knew that, but Rena, I'm not sure if you did.
No, thank you. That's very generous.
I encourage you to look that article up. We'll have Angel send it to you. Actually, it's a wonderful article, and it's so many similarities between your life story and his life story. And it's almost as like looking into your future 40 years from now. So it's really a cool, like, what was it? Back to the Future. This is going to be like, but we don't have the DeLorean. Other than that, it's going to be just a nice experience. But getting back to the point, I digress, right, as they say. Len, shout us out to your other co-authors that aren't with us today.
Yes, well, there four of us wrote the paper, Trust-Based Partnerships Are Essential and Achievable in Healthcare Services. The paper is published in the July 2021 issue of Mayo Clinic Proceedings. Again, we've published in that particular journal. It's a wonderful journal. And it actually, Tom, this paper was selected, unbeknownst to us until it happened, as the editor's choice for the July issue of the Mayo Clinic Proceedings. The editor each month selects one or several articles as his choice of articles that are must-read articles in that particular issue of the journal. And so we were delighted with that, and the editor made a video describing our, which is on the Mayo Clinic website, describing our article. Ren and I wrote this article with Karina Dahl Stephenson, who has been on the podcast with you and Angel. Stephenson is a medical oncologist at the Patients Cancer Center in Vejle, Denmark. And I work with her closely. She's a very good friend of mine. She's taught me a great deal. I've visited her cancer center multiple times, and she's visited me at my university. And so we collaborate. And so she was on this paper, did a wonderful job contributing to it. The more remarkable news in terms of the four authors of this paper is my honors student, Sanjay Lecherman, who is going to be a senior in the business school at Texas A&M, the Mays Business School of this academic year, is an author. And it's the first time we researched this, actually. It's the first time in the history of our business school that an undergraduate student has published an article in a major medical journal, or in any medical journal for that matter, in our business school. But this is a very rare young man. In fact, yesterday was his last day on his summer internship, where he served as an intern for the Senate Committee on Health. And so he had an incredible experience working with Democratic and Republican senators on healthcare issues this summer. And he told me he's coming back. He's coming back to College Station in the next few days. He's coming back with lots of stories for me.
Oh, I bet. And just, you know, again, you know, Rena's book, so moving, and this article, so moving. It was a week of inspiration for me and for our podcast listeners and survivors. Rena, why don't we start doing our deep dive on the article and have you talk about what we mentioned about trust and just competence versus competence plus more as the paper begins.
I think our patients have a right to expect that the people who are treating them are competent. That's clearly the most base level of what we should offer, but that is not enough for trust. We go into a number of aspects of what actually creates trust-based partnerships in the paper, and much of it centers around, I would say, aspects of care that haven't been as traditionally valued in medicine as perhaps they should be. The sort of empathic creativity is one of my favorites. You know, there are so many opportunities to meet the needs of our patients in ways that inspire more than confidence, more than trust, but a kind of reverence and awe that another human would hold them in this way. And the truth is, they can be very small acts. After my most recent surgery, which was during the pandemic, I had not eaten for a number of days. And the only thing I could think that I could maybe try was tea. And my physician assistant, who was caring for me, went to get sort of her favorite tea from the coffee kiosk instead of making the tea that would have been available on the floor. And it was such a small act, but she went out of her way to show that truly my comfort mattered. And that kind of creativity, discretionary effort, I think is essential.
I think, Rena, that's a beautiful point, because there really is, again, we hope to reach out, of course, to survivors. This is for them. This is for them, for their toolbox, for their survivorship. But we also hope to touch caregivers as well. And it's a really nice nod that you mentioned to the small things, the small little acts, those beautiful things you wrote in the paper, something as small as, you know, a nurse braiding a young girl's hair, you know, before surgery to sort of help that girl maybe not be as epilated as she may have been otherwise if it was just someone doing their job. The small act of, you know, just helping a patient get their treatments done in light of a broken machine, staying late, sending someone to pick up a part so they could go on a survivorship celebration vacation the next day. These little things, even a cup of tea, you know, and then there's grander gestures like the thoracic surgeon or the surgeon who came back to dance with that young girl at her senior prom. Just so beautiful. But it is the little things, right? It is the little things. And I think what you're saying is for the providers to never think that, oh, they wouldn't appreciate this, they wouldn't appreciate that. The little things make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tom, when I teach my business school students service quality, one of the concepts I teach them is the concept of majoring in minors. Majoring in minors, doing the little things well, because what may seem like a little thing to the provider of that service can be a very big and meaningful thing to the receiver of that service. The story that you alluded to that's in our paper, Tom, about Susan, that's not a real name, but Susan, Susan was my student several years ago in the healthcare seminar that I teach. And she's now 22, 23 years old. She's healthy. She's doing great. But at 14, she was diagnosed with brain cancer and needed brain surgery. And in her term paper, one of her term papers for my course, she wrote this beautiful paper. And we include an excerpt from her paper, an excerpt from her paper in our article. So Susan's term paper wound up, at least in part, in our article in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings. And I'd like to just read it for your audience. It's such a powerful story. She was 14 at the time when she had her surgery. And here's what she wrote in her paper. She said, when Ava, my nurse, came by before surgery, she looked me in the eye and she said, Susan, I'm going to braid your hair back so that we only have to shave what we need. What Ava did shaped how I viewed myself every time I glanced in the mirror during recovery and when I walked into school surrounded by normal girls. Ava probably doesn't remember braiding my hair, but that moment stuck with me for the past 6 years. Wow.
Very powerful, Lynn. Very powerful. And the entire article to me is that, you know, it's all about these things. Let's break it down actually into the four subcategories that you guys identified. And I'll have you guys go back and forth. I know Rena had already sort of begun talking about empathetic creativity, which is my favorite as well. Discretionary effort, seamless service, and fear mitigation. So why don't you guys split them up as you see fit?
Okay. Rena, which ones do you want to talk about?
You pick yours and I'll follow.
Oh, bless your heart, Rena. Okay. So let me talk about, start with empathetic creativity, and just to add on to what we were already talking about, because we were talking about empathetic creativity in these stories that Rena told and I told. But the reason that that's in the paper, Tom, is what we're trying to do is we're trying to combine two very, very important concepts in serving patients, in healing patients with illness, disease, in helping patients who are frightened about their illness. And those two powerful concepts, when you put them together, become so much more powerful. When you put empathy, which is putting yourself in the other person's shoes and being non-judgmental and truly listening to them and then trying to find a way to help. When you put that idea of genuine empathy together with the idea of creativity, of if you need to, you bend the rules a little bit. Mm-hmm. If you need to, you do what has to happen as opposed to what your job description says you should be doing. And you put empathy and you put creativity together and something magical often comes out. And many of the stories in our paper, but many of the stories in Rena's book, many of the stories that we're familiar with from other sectors of healthcare, illustrate the power of combining empathy and creativity. That my favorite story, maybe not the only one because I like them all.
They're all great, Len.
Yeah, but I love the story in our paper about the two long married husband and wife. Both had COVID at the same time. Both were hospitalized and both were about to die from COVID. And they were in separate rooms. And the hospital staff, and Rena, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're really, they didn't ask permission to do this. They simply put the husband and wife in the same room. They moved two beds together and they joined their hands. Mm-hmm. So they both died within minutes of each other holding hands. That's empathetic creativity, Tom. That's beautiful. And that illustrates what's possible when we serve.
It's while Angel and I were setting the table for this episode last week, well, it'll be aired the week before this actually episode goes in. We told an interesting story about a fishing pole you'll have to listen to and about a security guard who wouldn't bend the rules. And I invite you guys to listen to that episode because it really is it's shocking how little you have to do to make such a huge impact.
And truly that became even more pronounced and important during the pandemic. Because of the isolation that patients were experiencing and, our inability to know them as whole people who were members of a family because of the visitor restrictions. And it really, there are many, many terrible aspects of this pandemic, and I don't want to fetishize it, but there are things we've learned that will change medicine going forward in a good way.
Well, actually, I had asked you this off air, and I'll have you comment on it now. As a critical care physician, pulmonary specialist during the coronavirus, and this paper is about trust, and this podcast is about having our survivors how to have engaged their health service to have a trusting relationship with them. It must have been quite a challenge to develop trust in family members who you couldn't see, who you couldn't talk to, couldn't sit personally eye to eye, and then them trusting you blindly. They may have read your CV and, oh, wow, this person is well-trained, but, I've never met them, blah, blah, blah. Can you spend a few minutes on that challenge?
Yeah, this has been a tremendous challenge in terms of trust. And it's evolved. I can tell you that at the beginning of the pandemic, we had our worst first wave in Detroit in April of last year. And I remember vividly sitting with one of my colleagues who's one of my good friends, and she had just had an end-of-life conversation with a family member by phone. At that time, the mortality rates were terrible. We didn't know how best to treat this disease. And the family member was incredibly understanding, and the conversation was about how the patient was going to die regardless of whether we did more, like CPR, if their heart were to stop. And the family member, after listening to what the physician explained, said, "I don't want any of you risking your own lives if he's going to die anyway," and gave them permission not to go into the room. And, you know, that was heartbreaking and beautiful and a testament to community. But what the physician took away was that it was crazy that we were having these conversations over the phone and that she couldn't look this person in the eye. So literally within 48 hours, we had gotten iPads for all of the units so that these conversations could happen over at least FaceTime or WebEx or whatever we had to do. But we knew that this was a human moment and it needed to be made as human as possible. Since that time, it's been, you know, we're going into our fourth wave now in Detroit, and it's harder because we are caring for people who don't believe that this disease exists, even as they're dying of it. And it's an incredibly heartbreaking thing to see someone wish that they could get vaccinated as they're dying. And that is taking a different toll, I think, on the workforce than the first three surges did, because again, there's this adversarial nature and it's very difficult to heal without trust. I've seen patients use their last moments to ask that their family get vaccinated after suddenly recognizing that they've made the worst mistake possible and they've trusted misinformation.
Beautiful, beautiful. You know what, I to segue back to the paper, the thing that I have the hardest time in my practice, Rena, I'm not sure how your practice is structured. I'm assuming it's a captured medical staff where everyone's employed by the hospital, but here in our hospital, it's of different groups, and the seamlessness of care is so difficult. I have patients that will see a practitioner, get their diagnosis, and then be presented to tumor board, see the other specialists. And by the time the treatment gets done, it might be 6 weeks, 8 weeks, you know, and there is no seamless service. Which one of you guys wants to take that on?
Service is literally Len's life. So I am going to defer to Len.
Yeah, so Tom, and the story that you just told, which is repeated every day in this country, unfortunately, in cancer and in other serious illness, and that is fragmented service, uncoordinated service, long delayed service. And what we write about in terms of building trust-based partnerships is the importance, among other concepts, the importance of making the service as seamless, as timely, as effortless as possible for the patient, because the patient has enough to worry about. To add stress upon the stress of illness, the stress of not being able to get an appointment, not getting a phone call returned, not having a second doctor you see that's part of the care, being uninformed about what the first doctor has said or not having access to the first doctor's records, that's not seamless service. And that does not build trust. It does not create confidence. And it just adds more stress to an already inherently stressful experience for the patient, by simply being ill, by being ill or injured. And so that's the issue that we talk about there. We talk about the importance of removing the friction from the healthcare service system so this patient and family can concentrate on the illness itself and not have to worry about all of these other moving parts and being responsible for coordinating them or getting them together and getting them to work. And that's really the basic issue that we discuss in that section of the paper.
Well said, Len, very well said. Renna, fear mitigation.
You know, that section of the paper was very important to me personally, because I think it points out how much of what the patient needs us to attend to is not often attended to. One of the most striking things about my own experience as a patient was simply the loss of identity. I didn't think about illness in that way, that it would take away things that were essential aspects of who you were. And so I especially appreciate the scripting in the paper, that there are ways that you can ask these things, you know, what concerns you most about your illness? That's such a generous, open-ended question that really allows the patient to feel that they can say whatever it is. And it may be the financial burden of cancer care. It may be fear of medical bankruptcy. It may disclose that the patient's not taking their medications the way that you thought you had co-created this plan of care for them to take it because of cost. That is essential, I think, and points to a space that we have a lot of room to move into.
I agree. I think I used the analogy, I don't know if you guys are Harry Potter fans, but we looked at the that episode where they talked about the Bogart and how each of the students had a fear and how to mitigate that fear. And I think that that's so nicely stated in your paper. And we do try to do that in the cancer world. And I think that my colleagues do a really nice job on that end. So I think we're sensitized, but I think all disciplines, you know, need to go down that road of fear mitigation. I think that's very important. Len, do you want to talk a little bit about hiring for value and skill, not just by skill alone?
Yes. Hiring well is really the first step in creating better service for your customers in general, for your patients in a healthcare context. If you don't hire well, then everything else you try to do to improve service quality in your organization is going to be hampered, is going to be constrained, is going to be more difficult to achieve. And so in this particular part of the paper, we talk about the importance of hiring not just for competence, which you absolutely need, as Renna has stressed, and which is, I believe, obvious to anyone in healthcare, that we have to have the competence of the physicians that care for us, the clinicians that care for us. But hiring well also means hiring for values. Hiring the right people with the right skills, as opposed to hiring people with the right skills. You need them both. And Renna expressed that so beautifully earlier in the podcast today, Tom, that a truly great clinician cannot be great only with competence. A truly great clinician is one that's going to establish a strong sense of trust and partnership with his or her patients and with the families. And in order to do that, it goes beyond competence, which is a given, we need that, but it goes beyond competence to compassion, to caring, to extra effort, which we call discretionary effort in our paper, to doing the little things well, majoring in minors. It goes beyond that. And here's where we get into someone's individual value system. And so, you know, when I write about this or give talks on this particular issue, the way I express it typically is hire the person, not the resume.
Well said. As I'm sitting here next to my friend Angel, who works in the hospital switchboard, and he's exactly the type of person I would want in my organization, because he's a skilled, smart young man, but he has such vision and he goes above and beyond for this organization. And that's the exact example of what we're looking for. Is there anything that I missed in the article? Is there anything in the article that you guys would like to expand upon before I move on to our closing questions?
I think that Renner or I should share with your listeners, Tom, the prom story.
The what story? I'm sorry.
The prom story.
Oh, sure. Actually, I'd be happy to. Actually, I'm going to kind of take a page out of your book, Len, and I'm going to actually read it.
Oh, okay.
Which I thought was beautiful. Yep.
It's the end. It's the way we decided to end the article.
Oh, it's beautiful. Absolutely. Let's see. We have it was Stephanie, I believe.
Yes, that's the story.
So, quote, Stephanie, an 8-year-old girl from Michigan, was headed into surgery for a heart transplantation at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She asked one of her doctors, Mike Ackerman, if she was going to live. Dr. Ackerman replied, "Of course you're going to live, and I'm going to dance with you at your high school prom." 10 years later, in 2009, with the consent of Stephanie's parents, but unknown to her, Dr. Ackerman flew to Michigan to surprise Stephanie at her prom. The story of a prom promise kept captures the beauty of healthcare at its best, a force for true healing for patients and for the clinicians who care for them.
Yeah. I love ending with that story because I think it points to the reciprocity that exists when you invest in that kind of trusting, compassionate relationship, that it doesn't deplete the clinicians, it actually nourishes them.
Absolutely. And Len, I have a closing question for you. It's actually more of a statement than a question, but I truly hope that you never retire. And I truly hope that you continue to churn these papers out because we're listening. I'm listening. The cancer survivorship community is listening. You have made a great difference in your life's work. And please tell me you're not planning to retire.
No, I'm not. I'm going to keep going as long as I can, Tom. The work that I'm doing is so inspiring to me, because I know it's helping other people. And in my work, I have interviewed and met so many brave patients and their families, and so many brave clinicians who do this kind of work, who work with really sick people, whether it's cancer or another illness. And the people that I've met, the patients, the families, the clinicians, they inspire me. I mean, the opportunity to work with someone like Rena Oddish, I mean, what a gift.
What a gift. That is true. That is a true gift. Rena, I'm going to ask you a question. You're now at a point in your life where you have survived the unsurvivable. You have had to metabolize the unmetabolizable. We make up words here, by the way, in our podcast. and where do you see your work in the next 10 years? Because right now you already are working on a communication curriculum to help us out in the world to be better at the second part. Where do you see yourself?
It's a big life question for Saturday.
Drinking tea before, so you're ready for it.
I hope that 10 years from now, I'm still writing with Len Barry, because he is one of my idols, and I value that relationship so much. And being with him today and you has been a joy for me. The space that I'm working on now is really the intersection of story and medicine. I'm very interested in how we can use story to advocate for our patients, both in an institutional and a national level. I'm interested in physician identity and how that develops and how we can curate it in a thoughtful way so that we bring our values and attributes into our career in a way that's authentic. And I'm interested in growing both of those things so that the next generation of physicians is armed with the tools they need to provide empathic and compassionate care to patients.
Well, you have certainly touched me, my friend, and it's such an honor that you are both here. I always tell the Croc Nation that when we have guests, especially guests of the caliber that we have here, Len and his friends, this is a new podcast. This is an experiment. We're not established names. We're not Michael Jordan or Katie Couric or all of these famous people who have a podcast. We're just two knuckleheads sitting in an office and, trying to serve our cancer survivors. So that faith that you have in us is so, so appreciated, and to take time from your busy lives. I always end the podcast with a perspective from a layman, from my friend Angel Santana.
Hello, everybody. It's an honor to be a listener and to produce this show. I want to just share something that I've never shared with anyone, which actually coincides with this article. And for those that listen to the show, I don't tend to know what we're going to talk about. I want to get the shock and awe value so that I can feel it and not just sit here and take it all in. In 1996, I had back surgery. I had scoliosis, and I had a 73% chance of probably never walking again. I broke those odds. But I remember, as I had a flashback, I remember using up all my morphine for the day. And I remembered a nurse who knew that I was inspired by professional wrestling and knew that I loved music and knew that I was in pain, decided to jump into the bed with me after her shift, rub my hair, and sing a song to me. I can't remember what the song was, but I do remember falling asleep. And when I woke up, it was the next morning. So as a patient, I can understand that. I would also like to point out that I'm very grateful for Len, because he's brought these people into our lives. So for that, I thank you. But I want to just I'm a person that does a podcast. As they know, it's called Have Faith, Let It Begin. It's a spiritual, motivational type of podcast. But for Rena, I'm a firm believer that things don't happen by accident. So I wanted to share something that was in my heart while you were explaining your story and will coincide with how you met Len. Things don't happen by accident. We are brought onto this world and we are met with people that we would never expect to ever meet. When we meet those people, we connect, and connect in a way that can be so much far worth breathtaking, I should say. But in your line of work and what happened to you, we're given three things. We're given a talent, a treasure, and a gift. You have been given all those three, despite the most horrible thing that I can imagine as a father of a two-year-old and one that's now at her 6 months, we're at 6 months pregnant. I just am very, very humbled, because it's not easy to put your story out there. And I'm a firm believer that people that can take it to that level can humble themselves, put their story out there so that others can hear and learn from it. It's not an accident. Maybe we'll never understand it. We can never explain it. We never could understand why it would have to happen to us. But when you change people's lives just by telling that story, it makes a difference in the world. And it's because of that, you're going to change people and you're going to help people. So for that, I'm sending you many blessings.
Thank you, Angel. That was a beautiful reflection of your faith.
That was awesome, Angel. Thank you very much. I want to invite you both to come back to the podcast. Len, I know you're going to come back. And please bring new friends.
Or old friends. Hello.
You can't get away that easy, Renna. You will be a regular. There's no question about it. Actually, I take an opportunity. I want to show everyone the book, although we're not on YouTube yet. But In Shock by Dr. Renna Awash. I'm sorry, Audish. I had made a promise before you guys came on in the introduction. I told everyone in the Croc Nation that this book they need to read. This book will change their lives. This book will inspire them. I also told them that if they contact us and they don't have the resources to purchase this book will be sent to them by the podcast. So I want to just let you guys know that your beautiful, beautiful baby girl has made a huge difference in this world to me. Her short life has reverberated and touched me. Your story has touched us all. And I want to take a moment to shout out to our people, how grateful we are to Len and to Renna. We end this podcast as we end every podcast with gratitude. Angel Santana, Half Faith, Let It Begin. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Rod Freeman, Small Biz Up. Thank you. Michael John Benzea, Charlotte Larson, our wonderful, trusting, loving patrons. Thank you. And as I end every podcast, on behalf of Angel Santana, Dr. Renna Audish, Professor Len Berry, we wish all of you, all of our cancer survivors, a long, healthy, happy, and cancer-free life. God bless you. God keep you. Peace.